Page 139, the impartation of Adam's corruption to his descendants. You've read through this material. On page 143 following, the development of the doctrine, what depravity is not and what it is, not a corruption of the essence of the soul spirit, and what essence means, not a stuff or substance infused into the soul spirit, not merely a privation or loss of good. What it is, a number of statements there, and the meaning of total depravity. Statements by Burkhoff, very good statement by Augustus Hopkins Strong, brief statement from Lewis and Demarest, the emphasis on holistic rather than total, and Hokema, emphasis on pervasive rather than total. They feel those terms more adequately express the idea, and those terms have something to be said in their behalf. Total is a little misleading. So, on bottom of page 146, when we use this word total, which has historical coinage, what do we mean by it? Good evening, David. What do we mean by total in total depravity? Well, you've read this. All of a person's faculties and powers, thus total in extent, not as corrupt as one can be, so not total in degree. Total in extent, but not in degree. And the diagram on page 147 attempts to help with that. Here are two human beings, one of whom is more depraved than the other in degree, but not in extent. Both are equally depraved in extent. The difference here is pictured as one of degree. And really, the way to make this really work is to put it on an overhead and have it move. I mean, have the liquid go up or down, you know, so that you get a more graphic representation of the idea of degree becoming more or less depraved in degree. A question might be raised in regard to the diagrams. Say, in human being B, does it ever get to the top? Probably not in this life. In human being A, does it ever get down to the bottom? In other words, does a person become less and less depraved until all the depravity is gone? Answer, no. And on page 147, I'll get to you in a moment, Young. Page 147, that second paragraph under E, I think we can probably think of people we've met, or that is personally, or people we've met in history or literature who are more cruel than others, or more hateful, more malicious, etc., etc. So that this is borne out in experience, this concept of differing degrees of depravity. Now, Young, well, see, the letter F on page 147, I say it suggests the possibility that they may be born unequally depraved in degree. Only suggests, you notice how carefully I chose the words, and the possibility. Talk about the 1,000 qualifications. Well, you know, it's really qualified heavily. But at least it's worth thinking about. For those who came in after we began, let me repeat. If you missed a quiz, it's in an envelope up in the academic office on Mrs. Tressler's desk. And if you missed an examination, that's also in an envelope. And you may take that at your convenience and then just put it in my mailbox. But I would urge that you take the quiz before you forget what the material was that was quizzed over. Questions on this section? You've read Boston, so Austin is very graphic and very descriptive, very impressive in dealing with this matter of the second state, the state of depravity. And Holcomb is also very helpful in some of the things he treats, some of the distinctions he makes. As you've read that as well. Jenny.
I've always wondered on page 141,
when
that death is 6-5,
yes.
The Lord saw that the wickedness of the man was great on earth. Every intent of the thought of his heart was only evil continuous. Do you think that that's just a state prior to the fall, or do we assume that that's true now? That every intent of the thought of our hearts are only evil continuous? Or is that true of an unregenerate person now?
Prior to the flood. It's a good question. It is awfully strongly stated. Yeah. And yet, you know, if you look at that, the Psalm 14 and the quotation in Romans 3 may be just as strong but positively stated, that is, negating the positive. There's no one who does good. And then the Romans 3, there's none righteous, there's none who understands, none who seeks for God, none who does good, not even one. And then the rest of that, very strongly worded. And that appears to be universally applicable rather than to one time period.
What I question is then Romans 2:14.
Yes.
And this where it says the Gentiles do the things with the law, even though they don't have the law. Because it's the law of the heart. But it does say
that they
do the
things. Yes. Could it be that a distinction that is to put these two together, somehow to meld them together, could it be that in the Romans 2:14-15 passage that Paul is saying that the Gentiles who don't have the Mosaic law do from their nature things which the Mosaic law prescribe, but in doing those things they do not do any more than what might be called external righteousness, external, that which is in external accord with the law. But if you add the dimension of motivation, purpose, as to why they do the things they do, then that may color it considerably. So that if they do things that are in an outward accordance with the Ten Commandments, yet they do them not out of love for God, or out of a voluntary desire to obey his commandments, but they do these things for various reasons which fall short of those high motivations, in which case you could say even while they do that which is an external conformity to the law, they're still sinning. Curiously enough, in the same act. Dr. Van Til used to say that the unregenerate man, when he drinks a glass of water, is sinning. And you wonder, what in the world does he mean by that? He sins when he drinks a glass of water. Well, he explained that by saying that the unregenerate person takes God's good gift doesn't recognize it as God's good gift, doesn't give thanks in his heart. He drinks the water as though it were a surd, a given, that which has objective reality cut off from any relationship to God. And he takes this good gift and takes it without appreciation to God who's given it. And he takes that even though he's a creature of God and is sustained by God. And he doesn't give thanks. He doesn't recognize God. In fact, he refuses to recognize. He suppresses that truth. And he takes the glass of water. And in so doing, he's sinning, looking at it from that angle. So if we could look at it from those two angles, on the one hand, a person may be externally a good father or a good mother or an obedient or respectful child. But on the other hand, when we ask what is the motivation involved in that is, if motivation is important, if obedience to the law should really be an expression of love to God and love to our fellow human beings, if that's what obedience should be, and if that's what should motivate the external obedience, then if you take away the motivation, you still have the external conformity, but how does God view that? And you can say, well, through common grace, the person's not totally bereft of the image of God, certainly not bereft of the workings of conscience, certainly not bereft of the common grace workings of the Holy Spirit. All of that is true. And yet they're sinning, even if they do something that is externally in conformity with God's law, but from the wrong motive. And then you can start asking what motives move people to do things, say, that are in external conformity to the law of God. Is it possible that we could view motivation from two sides? On the one hand, you may not hate another person or have malice toward another person, but suppose you don't have love for the other person, love the way God defines it, and you could ask whether omission of that, with failure of that, would also constitute sin. Even though, as you mentioned, in the common grace sphere, a person may have compassion on another person. Again, it gets, I think, dangerously close to the problem of defining what kind of a God we're talking about and how these ideas of love to God and love to our neighbor are defined, not just in the sphere of knowledge, but in the sphere of reality. So I think that might enter in. I suspect that we don't get deeply enough into the question of motivation and right motivation to know whether an act is pleasing to God. That is, if it's not from a motivation that's pleasing to God, we have to ask if the external act is pleasing to God. And admittedly, all we can do is see and hear. We can see what the person does and we can hear the person talking as to why he or she did it. Or does it? But it's a similar problem, I think, to the problem that we strike when we ask a person Are you suppressing the truth of the knowledge of God? And part of the problem is that in answering that, they're involved in the very suppression of the truth. So that to suggest that they can get around that somehow and answer us truthfully while doing the very thing, that seems to be a problem. How to get past that for themselves to us, or how we get past that from ourselves to them, and look at that and actually do the survey and find out what's really going on there. Part of the problem is we can't get at the heart. That's part of the problem. And part of the problem is that the person himself or herself doesn't really know at bottom what's all going on in the heart because of its deceitfulness. So a person may feel that he or she knows his heart, knows himself, knows herself, and may not. Jeff?
Does that mean that an unregenerate person cannot do something that truly pleases God?
Yes, it means that.
So all these acts that we see that we would categorize as good things, helping the poor, helping children that are sick, the Peace Corps,
Now, let me split my answer. When I said yes, I said that too hastily. Let me split my answer. Are those acts pleasing to God? On the one hand, the acts, in terms of what is done and the outcomes, are in general pleasing to God. On the other hand, the acts as done by the individuals cannot please God vis-a-vis the individuals. So there are things which people do that are pleasing to God, that are in accordance generally with His will, but yet these persons cannot please God in their standing and their relationship to God. I think Romans 8, so therefore those who are in the flesh cannot please God, would emphasize that aspect. But these other things we realize that are in accordance with God's will, who doesn't desire the death of the wicked, who takes no pleasure in their death or in their pain or in their suffering, so that if we can alleviate, or if something of that is alleviated, we can say that in general that pleases God. So I spoke too quickly. I'd have to split the answer. Yes, thank you. Thanks for sharpening the point.
So what we're saying is that there's a fundamental condition, that being salvation. And in order for you to please God, it is impossible for you in yourself and in your specific action to please God in any other realm if you have not pleased Him in the fundamental belief in Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not standing properly in that, then you're constantly in a state of disobedience, and so there's not even any sense in discussing any other issue, because you don't have the first issue straightened out yet.
Mm-hmm. That's, I think, why Van Til said this about the drinking of the water. He could have used any other illustration. Now, it seems very strong to say something like that, that the unregenerate sins when he takes a drink of water, but until you start defining the whole situation, taking all of that into account. The question might be raised, what is the most serious sin you can think of? And all kinds of claimants come for that particular honor or dishonor, however you might call it. And if you get down to rock bottom, it seems that the most basic sin, not getting into the essence of sin, the most basic sin seems to be that human beings simply do not recognize God as God, and themselves as creatures who owe God their existence and owe Him worship and service. That seems to be the most basic of all sins. And that's a sin which takes place every moment of the unregenerate person's life. So that tends to overshadow everything else. And all these other things seem to be symptomatic of that. Of that basic attitudinal problem.
With the same example, does a Christian drink water without sin?
That's a very good question. Do they drink water without sin? You don't think so?
If you use that criteria, I fail the test.
Okay, all right.
No one drinks water without sin.
Okay.
Back into the ability to sin and the ability not to sin. So the Christian does not have to drink in sin, but he can.
And then the question which has to enter in, if he gives glory and praise to God for the water as a good gift, the question, of course, is, does he do that perfectly or imperfectly?
Yeah.
And see, I think that's what Steve is getting at, okay?
I mean, yeah, because if you take it on a level where, like, occasionally you're conscious of God's goodness in providing these things, but not, moment by moment, not every time you stop and count and get a drink, I give thanks and say, I don't know.
It may not be necessary to stop and say, blessed be God, the King of the universe, who gives water to drink, and so on. It may not be necessary to do that before you go to the water fountain. But it may be a question, again, of attitude. A question of attitude, which we have toward God as the giver of all good and perfect gifts. Whether we stop and say a special blessing before we drink. So I think that enters in. However, there is a feature of this that I think is important enough to erase this off the board. What standard does God have for obedience with respect to His law? What is the standard of obedience with respect to His law? Various theologians, biblical scholars have addressed this question. And some frankly say, well, this is the high and holy standard of perfect obedience to the law of God. By perfect obedience, they mean that not only the external act, but the internal states of the heart and the motivations and all that are in accordance with God's intention. Perfect obedience. Others have felt that's too high a standard. God lowers that standard, and here's the standard to which we're responsible. For instance, the Wesleys proposed the idea of evangelical obedience. Obedience to the gospel, and obedience to the gospel is simply love. And if we come up to this standard, we have perfectly done the will of God. So you can talk about Christian perfectionism. Here's the law of God, its standard. Here's a lowered standard. Finney made the standard even lower than that. Finney has a standard down here somewhere. And actually, it's not a standard like that. It's more a standard like this. That is, the standard varies for each individual. So each individual has a standard which for him is perfect obedience, or her is perfect obedience. Wesley has one which is higher than that, evangelical obedience, perfect love, and still others have the high standard of the law of God in terms of perfect obedience to it. does the will of God, obeys God, and pleases God. Ray had a point.
I'm just going back to what you mentioned about the fundamental sin being that of rejection of God, certainly not the next sin after that would probably be murder. Because in the one you feel the presence of God or feel the presence of God, and then you murder a human being, you murder image bearer of God, that would probably be the, I would think, the first on the list after that.
If we were to go with that, could we divide that and say, at the most serious level, if you want to call it the highest level of that, you could speak of the one who murders souls before you go to the one who murders bodies. Just a thought. You can imagine how serious that particular charge would be. But again, that's an interesting question. What would come next under that? Someone over here had a question. Forgot it? Okay. Someone here in the middle had a question. Young. I was referring not so much as I wasn't referring to the idea of annihilation. I was referring to the idea of destruction in terms of leading people into that which kills the soul spiritually. Or if they are already spiritually dead, leads them into eternal death. That kind of murder, which is very serious business, of course. Satan's called a murderer from the beginning, interestingly enough. And so you have to ask, what is being gotten at in that kind of language? Satan is out to destroy people's lives and then to murder their souls, if at all possible, to lead them into eternal death. Pretty serious business. Other comments, questions? Stephen.
It seems that in the discussion of how the unbelievers can please God or not, the word righteousness, would useful because I don't know why, but well, I may know why, but it's a bit troubling the statement that the sinner, when he drinks a glass of water, sins for every glass of water he drinks.
Mm-hmm.
I think it seems to be begging the question on why.
Okay.
Because the sinner is capable of doing righteous acts using the term righteous. I think you've already touched on it. There is such a thing as an act that is not sinful. Everyone has already said that. And I think we lose the broader range of the meaning of the word righteous if we don't allow for acts that are not in themselves sinful. Of course, before God, there is no gaining of a righteous standing on the basis of that acceptance of God.
Okay.
I don't know if we have it here, we eliminate the possibility of sinners.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in common grace and in external conformity to God's law, it's possible to do some things that are good, but only in a relative sense. Because again, if you bring motivation into play, one can, for instance, do good to one's neighbor and want to do it, desire to do it. Or one can sacrifice very greatly for one's children or for a friend. As Jesus said concerning the giving of a life for a friend, greater love has no one than this. So we've got to allow for that, as well as the Romans 2:14-15 that Jenny mentioned, plus a number of other things scattered through Scripture, as you say. The question is how to fit that together with these very strong statements about one who is unregenerate being unable to please God. And as a matter of fact, not only is unable to please God, but is hostile toward God and not subject to the law of God. If the law of God defines righteousness, and it's not subject to the law of God, then you really have to ask, what's going on there? Again, if it's not out of love to God, and if it's not out of a voluntary desire to do the will of God, but it is doing something which is expressed, say, in one's nature, and the rudiments of that which was originally written in one's nature, expressing itself in what are externally good acts toward one's fellow human beings, then again, you could preserve that distinction, being able to do certain relatively good things while being unable to please God. But I don't think you could come down to the bottom line and say this pleases God as far as this personal individual's relationship to God. And I don't think you have to confine it to standing in righteousness. I think you can make it broader than that. But Brian had a point.
I didn't quite understand what kind of person would it be, a false prophet?
Certainly contributory. Let's think of some examples of people who can murder souls, even if Satan is the great murderer. Still, he can use people to accomplish his purposes, and does. Let's think of concrete individuals who might destroy souls. Cult leaders. They certainly could come into that category. Suppose you have someone who's teaching liberal theology and leading people to distrust Scripture as a revelation, an authoritative revelation from and of God, and thus undermines that person's confidence to such an extent that the person no longer believes in the Bible, believes in some other authority, whether a writing or an individual or a school of thought or whatever, or a philosophy or a psychology, that could come under that category. It would seem that it would be necessary to have them doing something to get the other person actively to trust in that, however, trust in that which is in opposition to God, to speak of murdering souls. Now, there are lots of questions that are proposed in this section beginning on page 147a, plus there are some considerations that have to be made regarding temptation, which are rather important. So, with your permission, I'm going to push ahead on this, and then some of these things we've been talking about will come into play. First, you've read through these questions for discussion. The first one has to do with the standard of sin today. What is the standard of sin? If sin, even in the New Testament, is defined as in relationship to the law of God, so sin is lawlessness, and doing that which is contrary to the law of God is sin, then what is the will of God for today? Or what is the law of God for today? And I've got six claimants there. Does it include the Ten Commandments? Notice it doesn't say, is it the Ten Commandments, but does it include the Ten Commandments? Does it include other parts of the Old Testament? Very tricky question today. Does it include Christ's commands and teachings and examples as recorded in the Gospels? Now, admittedly, some people would still view that as law, because you haven't come to Pentecost yet. So Christ's commands and teachings and example, they'd still regard as Old Testament law, dispensation, or something like that. Does it include the golden rule of Matthew 7:12? You know the golden rule, of course. Or the two great commandments of Matthew 22. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Well, some would still say that's law. That's Old Testament. You see, that's the law dispensation. Does it include those Old Testament commands, exhortations, teachings, and examples that are restated in the New Testament? Well, most people would buy into that because they wouldn't have that dispensational problem then. If they're restated, then obviously they're applicable and binding. But even there, some people would say, as soon as you express the word binding, as soon as you say that, immediately you're back into law. You're out of grace as soon as you say binding. Does it include only those commands, exhortations, teachings, and examples found in those portions of the New Testament clearly related to the present dispensation? Well, what would those be? Well, for instance, only the parts of the Gospels that are after Christ's resurrection, maybe. Not the books of the New Testament that are specifically Jewish. I mean, in these people's view. What would be specifically Jewish? Well, for instance, Galatians, okay, and James, Hebrews, some other parts of the New Testament which wouldn't be included in, or wouldn't be clearly related to the present dispensation in these people's viewpoint. What is the standard? What is the will of God for us today that defines sin for us? It's a very sticky question. I was in a church a while back, and I spoke in the church on Sunday morning, and as I stood by the door shaking hands, a woman came by and said, she said, that was so helpful. She said, you know, I haven't heard a sermon. I'd spoken from the Old Testament. She said, I hadn't heard a sermon from the Old Testament in 2 years. Well, you know, it made me wonder why. Well, in that particular church, they felt that the Old Testament was simply for another dispensation. It wasn't for the present dispensation. And that, by the way, that's a caricature, too, of even a dispensational view. But you see, you can get into problems with this kind of a question. What is the will of God for today? And because of the confusion on this question, there's a great deal of confusion in what is coming out of the pulpits of this nation as far as definition of what sin is and how to undergird it with some authority. Some people want to borrow the Ten Commandments while rejecting the Old Testament as authoritative. Or they want to say, well, but the Ten Commandments are restated, except for the fourth, in the New Testament. And so they want to go at it that way. Well, I have no objection to that as long as they keep the Ten Commandments in there and recognize that the Ten Commandments are a summary of moral law. Secondly, is temptation sinful? If it isn't, when does it become sin? Is it a sin to be tempted? Well, most people will say, no, it's not a sin to be tempted. But temptation can turn into sin. Well, when does it become sin? Do you have on page 147b a little chart, not a chart, a diagram sort of, called testing and tempting. Now, here's the problem. In James chapter 1, verse 13, And you've got a translation on page 147a. Let no one say when he is tempted. Well, see, the problem is the same Greek word means tempted and tested, both. So you've got to decide which one is being used in this context, tempted or tested. See, tested has one set of connotations, tempted another set. Let no one say when he is tempted, tested, I am being tempted, tested by God. For God cannot be tempted, tested by evil, and he himself does not tempt, test anyone. But each one is tempted, tested when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Well, when you look at this diagram, what I've done is I've run across upper and lower the two meanings, tested and tempted, but I've used instead of tempted, because that's a general word, I've used enticed with moral evil or tempted. So, taking the verse from left to right, let no man say, and running across the upper level, we read, let no man say when he is tested with physical calamity, I am being tested with physical calamity by God. For God cannot be tested with physical calamity, neither does he test any man with physical calamity. What's wrong with that translation? I mean, tested is certainly one of the meanings, proper meanings of the Greek word, which appears here in James 1:13. What's wrong with that translation? Anybody? What's wrong with taking it that way? Or if not translation, interpretation. What's wrong with that interpretation? What's wrong with that? Yes, the top level, going across the top. What's wrong with that?
He does test us. God does test us, that is, because Abraham threw a test, sacrificed his son. Now, the calamity part, I'm not sure about that. I think Job,
yes. He tested Job with physical calamity. That's right. That's Exhibit A. So you say, hey, look, you can't take it that way because God does test human beings with physical calamity. By test here, it means to prove the character of. Test. To bring out what a person really is. Test. In that sense. Well, if you can't take it that way, what about the bottom line? Let no man say when he is enticed with moral evil, I am being enticed with moral evil by God. For God cannot be enticed with moral evil, neither does he entice any man with moral evil. What's wrong with that interpretation? Right, by Satan. But this says by God. You're right. He was tested with moral evil, or enticed. Yeah.
What says, for God cannot be enticed with moral evil, right here.
Yes. As soon as we say Jesus, of course, we're talking about the God-man, and that presents a certain problem. Because then you have to ask, was he enticed with moral evil with respect to his deity or with respect to his humanity? And that complicates the matter greatly. Oh, well, I don't see anything wrong with it either, but I just wanted to see if you saw something wrong with it. Let no man say when he's enticed with moral evil, I am being enticed with moral evil by God, for God cannot be enticed with moral evil, neither does he entice any man with moral evil. Okay. Now, the idea here, suggestion on page 147a, seems to be in James 1:13 through 15, using a figure here, that each person is drawn by his or her own sinful desire, not by God, to the object of temptation to commit adultery with that object. think of it as a highly symbolic concept. At the moment he or she commits adultery with that object, sin is conceived. Thus, lust thus gives birth to sin. Sin, when it is full grown and complete, gives birth to death. That is, a lifetime of sin ultimately leads to eternal death. Think of it in that way. James 1:13-15. The figure here, each one is tempted when he's carried away and enticed, and when lust has conceived, gives birth to sin, so forth. Now, the next page, 147c, suggests a sequence in the elements of temptation. In a given instance of temptation, let's take what you've got at the fall, Adam and Eve, and the temptation by Satan. Notice, we've got here a set of normal physiological and or psychological needs and or appetites in Adam and Eve. We've got a set there. God created them with these appetites and these needs. Second, an ability to be attracted to an object capable of attracting a normal need or appetite. They have that ability to be attracted. For instance, it says in the account that the trees were good to eat and they were beautiful to look at. And God created them that way. Thirdly, an object capable of attracting a normal need or appetite. So you've got these trees in the garden and the fruit hanging there. You've also got another tree in the middle of the garden, and it has beautiful fruit, and it looks beautiful, this tree. It's capable of attracting this normal need or appetite. Looks beautiful, looks delicious. Fourthly, an emotion of attraction toward this attracting object. So you look at it, and you're attracted to it. It's an emotion. Fifthly, a prohibition imposed by some authority of the satisfaction of a normal need or appetite by means of an attracting object. So God says, you shall not eat of it. So here's a prohibition. Now, you're attracted to it. There is an emotion there, and God created it with the ability to attract. But now, six, you have an active desire to satisfy a normal need or appetite by means of a prohibited attracting object. Here's this piece of fruit, which everybody calls an apple. I'd rather think of it as a mango, because I don't like mangoes. But anyway, no, I'm only kidding. An active desire to satisfy this need or appetite by means of this prohibited attracting object. It's attractive. It attracts Eve to it, but it's prohibited. Now what you've got on her part is an active desire, by which I mean a desire which is accompanied by will, an active desire. It's not a passive desire. It's not just number four, this emotion of attraction. You're attracted to it because it's attractive. But here's an active desire with the prohibition in mind. Okay, here's a prohibition in between number four and number six. Now here's an active desire, in spite of the prohibition, to satisfy with this prohibited attracting object. Number seven, an establishing of this desire as a settled disposition. So now it becomes settled. It's not just a momentary desire. It's a settled desire. Eight, an opportunity to implement a settled disposition in favor of the satisfaction. So now here's an opportunity to do it, to take it, to have it. Number nine, a movement of volition. The will now says, I'm going to do it. I'm going to take it. I'm going to have it. It commits one to a course of action. And then 10, an action. The action itself, the reaching out and the taking, the having of the prohibited attracting object. Now, if just if, for the sake of argument's sake, you took number 5 and put it at the head of the list, number 1, and then made 1, 2, 3, and 4, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Okay? Just for argument's sake. So that number 5 would become number 1 and number 4 would become number 5. Then number 5 would be this emotion of attraction, and number 6 would be this active desire, and number 7 would be the desire settles in as a bent, as a disposition. Where does sin enter the picture? Does it come in 5? Does it come in 6? 5 now, as I've moved 4 down into 5. Does it come in 5? Does it come in 6? Does it come in 7? Does it come in 9? Does it come in 10? Where does sin actually enter the picture? Where does sin actually enter? I don't mean sin when it's finished, as James says, but where does sin enter the picture? When does it become sinful?
It's number 1 somehow is already there. If you explain it quite logically, it's putting the prohibition as number 1, that somehow is presupposed. It already exists.
And I don't mean now the possibility of sin. I mean the actuality of sin. When does sin take place? Okay, but suppose we put 5 up in number 1. Then where does sin take place in the sequence? Bart.
I'll take 7. Jump on number 7.
Number 7. Where it becomes a settled disposition.
And I say that in regard to some of the comments about one hating one's brother being guilty of murder and lusting after a woman being guilty of adultery. So therefore, I think at some part prior to the action, one already has
now, you've got a good point. It's somewhere prior to the action, the external action. I think that's a good point. I think you can establish that. The question is, how far back? Yes, that's the question. Now, I don't know who was next. There were a couple of people that were suddenly here. Stephen.
The word in Genesis number... an active desire?
Yes.
The word active there seems to me to imply a resistance to the prohibition. And of course, if that's something that's going to happen, it's in existence at least, even if it's in existence.
So you'd push it even farther back than 7, push it into 6, because active here means the will cooperating. So it's a desire with the will cooperating. It's not just an emotion, as in number 5, that is now 5, 4 before now 5. Not just an emotion, but it's an active desire. Steve, and then Ray.
He's saying that you put 5, make 5 number 1, which assumes that when it says an emotion and attraction for an attractive object, and for that attractive object is prohibited.
I didn't say that. I don't think I said that.
Well, okay, because Stephen, I'm assuming that he's assuming that that's a prohibited attracting object.
Yes, it is a prohibited attracting object. In number 4, now 5. It's prohibited, but there is still an...